Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to be talking to Peter Ledbrook. Now, before I get started, I really want to talk about a couple of things that I've got going on here. I'm going to start doing the videos again. I really apologize for that. I kind of got behind on that. I've been sick and the holidays, and anyway, there's not really a good excuse. I guess there is if I'm dying or something, but anyway, those will be coming back up. But I also want to point out that before we get started, I'm going to be doing a webinar at the beginning of February. And basically, it's going to be here's how to set up Ruby on Rails and get started with it. Probably be an hour, maybe a little longer than that. But I'm basically going to go over here's how you set it up, here's how you get things running with it, and then I'll take questions from people who may have issues getting it going. That includes on your servers, so if you have feedback or input, questions that you want answered for that, then keep an eye out, and I'll let you know when that is. You can also sign up for the mailing list on the website, and I'm going to send an email out to the mailing list when I have the details hammered out, and we can kind of run with that. So that being said, here's the interview. Hey, everybody, this is Charles Max Wood from Teach Me to Code, and this week we're going to be talking to Peter Ledbrook. Peter is, he works for VMware, and he's a Groovy and Grails evangelist. Welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Well, thanks very much, Chuck, for having me. It's been a while since I've done a podcast. I was work with my colleague Glenn Smith doing the Grails podcast, and he's based in Australia. So yeah, it's good to be back on the microphone again.
Oh, I can only imagine what lining up that time is like. How many hours off are you guys?
It depends whether it's winter or summer, but it can vary between 9 and 11 hours difference.
Oh, wow.
Time zone difference. So yes, it's late night for one of us, early morning for the other.
Yeah, I know how that goes. I used to work with the team in India. Well, actually, when I was working for a company that was owned by EMC Corporation, which owns VMware as well. And so we would come in like 2 or 3 times a week at like 6 a.m. and they would stay late until like 7 p.m. and we'd have our meetings.
Yeah, we actually have something similar in our office. And of course, we have quite a few people on the West Coast in Palo Alto, San Francisco. So they start coming online at 5 o'clock in the afternoon our time, which is too bad. But there's not an awful lot of overlap there. But yeah,
that's 1 hour off from where I'm at. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll jump in and start talking about Groovy and Grails.
Yeah, sure. So I've been a developer since, well, I was one of those bedroom coders during the home computer revolution. I started pretty much on, I don't know if you guys, if you've ever heard of the ZX81, Sinclair ZX81.
Uh-uh.
It was a very British computer around the time of the Commodore 64, I think before then. So I got one of those when I was a kid. That was quite an interesting computer because it used to come with an extension, this memory pack that was a huge 16K. But the really interesting thing was if it got knocked or you didn't quite get it connected properly, the computer just wouldn't work. And of course, you're also loading stuff from tape drives. So that was good fun. Anyway, so I've been...
back when programming involved the finesse of not bumping your computer?
Yes, exactly. And where you could tell whether a program was loading correctly by the sounds that the tape recorder was making as it was loading the program. They were good times. I had an Amiga later and started programming on that. And, you know, I enjoyed a challenge, so I started with C. Other people would start with slightly more accessible languages. And then at some point I got into Java, and I've been doing Java for quite a while now, over 10 years. I don't want to say how much more over 10 years is. So you get to an age where you don't want to talk about it anymore. So
I have friends who used to program Java that don't want to talk about it anymore.
I have to say, I'm not from the punch card era. although I have great respect for the guys who are still doing it from then.
Yeah.
So I've, dabbled in all sorts of areas of development, and I've touched on, I did quite a bit of C++. I'm trying to banish that memory forever. I've done some Python, which made the C++ kind of thing, well, actually made C nicer to work with, so that was quite cool. Dabbled in Ruby a bit, and then found Groovy and Grails, and that's where my focus has been. But I continue to look around, and at the moment there's an absolute explosion of languages on the, certainly on the JVM, and I think outside of the JVM as well.
Yeah, there are quite a few that have come out. Doesn't Scala run on the JVM?
Yeah, so it was originally going to run, the JVM was the primary platform. They were working on .NET, a CLR version as well. Uh-huh. So I don't know whether that's still going, whether they're still developing that. I'm not sure. Right. But yeah, Scala, yeah. We've got... Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, they're quite a bit. And some of them are like ports over, so you have Jython and JRuby, and then you've got things like Groovy and Clojure. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, so you got the older ones, and Scala and Clojure, Groovy's been around since, I'm going to get the year wrong, but I think it's about 2001 when it originally started. But we're getting, there's a language called Phantom, there's a language called, there are Ceylon and Kotlin, there are various languages that are trying to take Java that bit further forward. As we wait for Java to evolve, it's like people have become impatient. So we need a new static language. So there's a lot of competition in that space as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where it all goes. And not even just on the JVM, but we have this kind of resurgence of other languages like JavaScript. And I see a few people programming in C again. And, it's interesting to see these other things coming back up.
Yeah, well, people never stopped programming in C. I think
that's true.
Java and C have been in the top, the top two languages for a while.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
So where does Groovy fit into this landscape? I mean, you've got all of these different options out there. Is it a statically typed or dynamic language? How much freedom do you have in that kind of stuff? And what kind of benefits do you think you see from the JVM? I guess I should just ask one question at a time.
I can tackle both of those if I remember.
Okay.
So, but to begin with, Groovy's a dynamic language, but it's got optional static types. So what that means is you can actually declare method arguments, you can declare variables with types, which can have some quite good. There are some good use cases for that, and when I talk about Grails, I'll talk about one there. But it particularly helps with integration with Java, because Java's statically typed, you can declare your own types to make sure that Groovy method calls are going to the appropriate Java methods in a Java library, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's still, 100% at the moment dynamic. So all the method dispatch is dynamic, and you can have untyped variables or typed. It's entirely up to you. And one of the other key benefits is, it's dynamic language like Ruby and Python, but it has a syntax that's more familiar to Java developers. So it's got all the standard naming conventions, standard class syntax, the curly braces, various loops. So a lot of similarity there. But it introduces, not only is it a dynamic language, but it introduces things like what we call closures. There is much argument, particularly in the computer science field, whether we should be calling them closures or not. But basically, they're like Ruby's code blocks with some differences. But finally, effectively something like first class functions, so functions that you can pass around. That's sort of the one of the biggest differences with Java. Plus, it cleans up a lot of the syntax. We get rid of a lot of the boilerplate. You know, I don't know how many people know who don't know Java. You know, if you come from a Ruby or Python background and you hear that Java doesn't have a list literals or map literals, I think these days that's kind of shocking.
Yeah, a little. I did some Java back in the day, but still.
It
just feels like modern language should have these things, but
yeah, exactly. And Groovy provides those. So you know, some people use Groovy as a nicer to use Java, and not necessarily for the dynamic nature of the language.
Uh-huh. Do you find that people who do that tend to write? I mean, does their code actually flow differently than people who are writing Groovy for Groovy?
I don't know. Difficult question. I don't see a lot of code like that. But you see, probably see more uses of interfaces and basically a lot of declared types. Mm-hmm. In fact, you find that more experienced Groovy developers mix it up, you know, actually use dynamic types and static types. For things like method signatures, having types there can really help effectively document the method.
Right.
And in the Java world, IDEs, if you declare a type, then IDEs have a much easier time of doing auto-completion and, you know, showing you what properties and methods are available. Mm-hmm. So there's advantages there as well.
Right.
I think I'm somewhere in between. I have generally embraced, you know, the dynamic typing because I like duck typing, particularly when it comes to testing. It makes testing much easier. And when it comes down to it, a type system is a safety net, but it's also a little bit of a straitjacket as well.
Right. So I kind of want to get into a little bit with Grails too. I have a friend of mine that he went from Ruby to Grails. And in fact, he actually turned over Teach Me to Code to me when he did that because he had been doing Ruby tutorials and wanted to kind of keep it that way.
Yeah.
So first off, one thing that we've noticed in the Ruby community is that a lot of people come to Ruby because of Rails. Do you see the same kind of thing with Grails, or is it kind of the other way around?
I think a lot of people come to Groovy via Grails, but I'm not sure it's necessarily as big as with Ruby on Rails. Although, you know, I think there are probably more reasons to learn Ruby now that aren't Rails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Rails helped give Ruby the lift. I think Grails certainly helped give Groovy a lift. But there are ways of using Groovy in Java projects that have nothing to do with Grails, the testing framework. So we have one called Spock, and that makes life much nicer for Java developers. It's very easy to integrate something like that into your standard Java project.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are more compelling reasons to use Groovy now than just Grails, but certainly it was, and I believe still is, a strong influence, just as it was for Ruby on Rails.
Okay. So what's kind of the approach with Grails? Is it MVC? And what are some of the things that they've done that you like with it?
So, yes, I mean, it is pretty much a standard MVC framework. You know, what I like is that under the hood, it's stuff that I'm familiar with. You know, there's the Spring framework there. It's using standard jar files and the dependency management. But when I first came to it, I did actually look at Rails first. But I think at that point, JRuby on Rails wasn't there at that stage. And we were doing JVM development.
Mm-hmm.
But it was through searching for Rails that I discovered what was, at the time, called Groovy on Rails. I don't think many people know that. But the name changed not long after that. So it was really just the ease with which you could get a web application up and running. I tried various frameworks. I'd looked at something called Struts. I'd looked at another thing called Tapestry, which had which seemed really nice, but actually I still struggled to get anything going very quickly. And suddenly Grails, you know, everything given to you out of the box, and you know, very similar experience to Rails. But you also don't really need to know much in the way of SQL to get started, because we go with a domain first model. So you write your domain classes, and this is where those static types come in particularly handy, because in your domain classes, each of the properties, you know, author name, you know, date of birth, such like, each of those is given a static type, mm-hmm. and then Grails can infer from that what type to make the corresponding column in the database.
Right.
So very different approach there. So you don't even need to know anything about how the database is modeled, certainly when you're starting up. So what else is there? That's pretty much everything. Utilizing Groovy's build, as you know, the markup builder for generating XML and now JSON, very, mm-hmm. very simply. I'm guessing that, you know, a lot of stuff that really works for me in Grails is also in Rails and probably been there for a while. So pretty much anything that's, you know, good in Rails, good in Grails as well. I think the way that we've tried to integrate into the whole dependency system, the Java dependency system, I mean, we don't have in the Java world a module system as there is in Ruby, for example. Right. What we have are these jar files. In fact, there used to be a little video taking the mick out of Java for having jars rather than modules. I remember it was a Rails guy and a Java guy. Anyway, so taking... I don't know if you remember that one.
are those... What are they? They're the Envy something videos?
I can't remember either. But yeah, basically, you know, you've got these jar files which are just zips of classes. But there's no real meta information included there. And you have to import every single class by package and so on and so forth. So that's still, you know, an issue with Java. You know, Java 8, we're looking to get a proper module system, but don't know how long we're going to be waiting for that. But what we do have is something that Maven has popularized, which are these online repositories of Java files, and the meta information is included in the build and on these online repositories. And so, you know, we now integrate with that, and that makes things, you know, generally nicer to work with. But also, you know, dependencies, I gather this is possibly a problem in the Ruby world. Dependencies are a difficult problem to solve.
It's something that we've struggled with as well in the Ruby community. I mean, we recently got our hands on something called Bundler, which is something that Carl and Yehuda wrote, and it basically manages your dependencies for you and makes it a whole lot easier. But yeah, it was definitely something that was an issue before. So.
Mm. Yeah, I'm having fun with RVM at the moment, and I've managed to. I don't know if you're a Vim user at all.
Yep.
Yeah, I've managed to kill my Command T plugin on my Mac OS X, and now
I can't
get it again. Yeah.
I haven't had any problems with that, but.
Apparently, if you get hold of Xcode 421 on Mac, life becomes awkward after that.
Oh. Okay, good to know.
So, yes, because Command T, brilliant plugin. Mm-hmm. But yeah, on top of that, we've got the fact that it works with the servlet specification. So you're still ending up with a standard Java web application with the deployment opportunities there. And of course, that appeals to many of the enterprise shops because they've got an investment in application servers, servlet containers, and the like.
Right. They already have the ecosystem in place. And so this exactly. took advantage of it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's... I said, you know, originally Grails is built on Spring, and it was something I was familiar with. You know, Spring gives you an application model. So not, you know, once you get outside of the front end, the controllers, you know, how do you architect your application behind the scenes? Because, you know, once you develop certainly bigger Grails applications, what you end up generally doing is your controllers become a thin layer just handling HTTP requests and responses. They then offload, rather than, you know, accessing the database directly, they will offload to a layer of services, you know, what we call Spring Beans. And then those services will interact with the database. And then once you've got that middle layer, a lot more options become available. You can start working with things like Spring Integration or Apache Camel is another project that does something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's about sort of setting up routes within your application and sending messages internally or sending them externally via adapters. And there are many sort of big Spring projects that bring a lot of interesting features. You know, most people who want access control just use Spring Security. We have a plugin for that that simplifies the, you know, uses the Grails conventions to simplify setting up Spring Security, right. Which is a, you know, it's pretty impressive and quite a, it's been around for a while. It's the heavyweight in the Java world, certainly in the servlet world, for access control.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I'm hearing you talk about is just that you have access to all of the libraries that are available to you, either as a Java programmer or a Spring programmer, as well as the things that are written specifically for Grails and Groovy.
Yeah.
I have the same friend that switched from Ruby to Grails. He actually switched back because he was building a Facebook application and, you know, and so in one sense you have all of these libraries, but in another sense he was saying, you know, Ruby has more libraries for things like building Facebook pages or, you know, maybe interfacing with some of these other APIs. Have you seen, some of these, you know, I hear the same thing about Ruby versus Python and doing like math. And things like that, where Ruby's math libraries aren't as comprehensive as Python's. And it's right. Generally because the language is newer, maybe the framework's a little newer. Have you experienced anything like that?
I don't think it's to do with the age of the language. Mm-hmm. It's really down to what communities have adopted the technology.
Okay.
You know, what kinds of companies have adopted Rails? Certainly, I think a large proportion have been startups, and you know, many startups want that social integration, and they're very agile, and you know, that kind of thing is important to them, and therefore the associated libraries have sort of come along fairly quickly. You know, in the Java space, it's much more. You know, Java's still fairly enterprisey, much less startups. Mm-hmm. And enterprises aren't so concerned with social integration. Or certainly they weren't. You know, I think they're going to become more aware. And so, yes, I would say that's the main reason why Java, for example, doesn't have many in the way of social integrations. Although we do have a Spring Social project that's gone 1.0 now. But we still need to wrap that in a Grails plugin and make it that much more accessible to Grails developers. And on the Python side, the math library, you know, many academics from a C background were using Python to script their C libraries, their numeric routines. So they have a lot of stuff, a lot of algorithms that they implement in C because it needs to run fast, but then they need to bring that all together and want a more accessible interface to it all. So they use Python. And I think that it's that community, the type of community, which has driven, more comprehensive maths libraries for Python, for example. Uh-huh. I don't have an awful lot of evidence for that, but that's certainly my experience. For example, when I was dabbling with Python, it was in a company that was doing image processing. It was associated with a university, the University of London. Mm-hmm. And the academics who were doing the algorithms for doing image analysis had their C and C++ code, and they were using Python bindings and then using Python to script those.
Right. So another question that I have is, you work in an enterprise, and you kind of talk about Java being enterprise-y, and what kind of applications does VMware have for Groovy and Grails?
How do you mean applications for?
So, for example, what do they use it for?
Right. I think we have some teams using Grails for internal applications, but I don't know how many. I have to admit that. And we have some people using Groovy for developing DSLs for for Java libraries or Java frameworks or Java applications. I don't know, to be honest. I don't know if there's anything public.
Right.
But of course, we have Cloud Foundry, which has that that support for several languages and frameworks, but Groovy and Grails are quite core to that.
Right. So I guess my last question is, where do you see Groovy and Grails going in the future?
That's an interesting one, particularly as we have a little conference going this week. So it's tomorrow and Friday, and we'll be discussing something of the future of Grails in one of the Friday sessions. But Groovy will, I think, continue to be, a premier dynamic language for the JVM. I think there are going to be more compelling reasons. There are going to be more frameworks and tools that use Groovy. One of the most interesting developments there is taking that optional static typing and adding the ability to do some type checking at the compilation time. Uh-huh. So, there are dynamic language advocates throwing their hands up in the air at that. But going back to the fact that there are a lot of people who use Groovy as a more accessible Java, but they still like their types, and they still like their IDEs, putting a red underline under properties and methods that don't exist on their classes. Mm-hmm. So, by adding that support, we help those people who like their types, who feel safer with their types and getting the auto-completion, and also very early feedback on typos and that kind of thing. Grails will focus quite hard on the plugin ecosystem. I think the plugin ecosystem is very important to us. I think it'd be important to many frameworks. Mm-hmm. Because there are basically people want to, they have a job to do. There's a specific task. You were talking about, Facebook integration and things like that. That's less about the core framework than, the libraries or plugins that are available to deal with those, to solve those tasks. So I think we'll see a lot more development, maturing of that area of the framework. And I think it's, you know, Grails 2 is just coming out, so that's due next week. And we'll probably continue to focus on just making life as easy as possible for developers, you know, and that's things like, you know, getting that better error reporting, making things more responsive. You know, we've improved those areas dramatically for Grails 2. You know, the reloading is... Ruby doesn't suffer from this problem as much. Being an interpreted language by default, you know, things like modifying your classes on the fly, it isn't something that the framework struggles to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the interpreter deals with the changes. Right. It is more difficult on the JVM because you need to recompile you need to recompile those classes, even in a dynamic language. You know, with Groovy, there isn't an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a shell or a console, which makes it feel like a interpreter, but it's not. So that whole recompilation phase makes life quite difficult.
Right.
But what we can do is we've hooked into the JVM, and so when it's compiled, we can reload those changes, you know, reattach objects, do all sorts of things. So the reloading experience is much better with Grails 2 as well. Huh. So
that's interesting. I'm curious, if somebody wanted to get into Groovy or Grails, what's the best place to go to do that?
Well, I think if you want to give certainly Groovy a go, there's the web console. There's a Groovy web console. I'll see whether I can. GroovyConsole.appspot, I think it is. Yeah, appspot.com. And there you can dabble with scripts. You can write your scripts in the browser and execute them and just play around. There is, you know, the Groovy website, there is documentation. I think still the best introductions are via one of the books.
Mm-hmm.
There is work afoot to, you know, improve the Groovy user guide and bring that all together and make it more accessible. For Grails, we've got the, you know, there is the user guide, but probably best starting off with some of the screencasts, the introductory screencasts. So there are some on the grails.org website. And there's something called groovyblogs.org as well.
Huh.
And that's basically an aggregate of various blogs related to Groovy and Grails. And you find a lot of articles through there as people are trying to do things, introductory things, but also more advanced things.
All right. Well, that sounds terrific. And we'll put some of the links to some of those resources in the show notes. I just want to thank you again for coming on to the podcast.
No, thank you for having me.
And, you know, hopefully people can kind of get an idea of what Groovy and Grails are all about. And if it solves their particular problem, they can give it a try.
Yep, definitely. It's very easy to, you know, test it out. As I said, go on online and you can write Groovy scripts there and all run right. them.
If people want to follow what you're doing, what's the best way to do that?
So I am on Google Plus. We just search for Peter Ledbrook. I'm also on Twitter under the ID P Ledbrook.
All right.
And those are probably the best ways, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming. And, you know, we'll probably have this up in a few weeks, and I'll let you know when we have it available.
Excellent. It was great talking to you, Chuck.
It was great talking to you, too.